Let everybody come in and get seated, and we'll get started. I told Brother Larry last Sunday night, I said, I'm going to be out of town next weekend. He said, that's okay as long as you're here at 9:30 Sunday morning. So here I am. It's good to see you. Got a little different type of lesson this morning. It's very relevant because of what's going on every day, as a matter of fact. On your news, on the computer, the information is put out. It has to do with the Middle East. And the lesson I want to present today is actually taken from a book written by the late Guyon Woods entitled The Biblical Backgrounds of the Troubled Middle East. Now, I know many of you will know a lot of this stuff that I'll be talking about. Some of it may be new to you. The first Sunday of this month, I believe it was August 3rd, there was on the back page of the first section of the Huntsville Times, there was an editorial, or actually a commentary, of national news, and the headlines read, "Kerry doesn't have a clue about the Middle East," talking about the Secretary of State, John Kerry. But out of fairness to him, the truth of the matter is, Washington, D.C., nobody there has a clue about the Middle East. And the reason is because if you're going to really want to know about that subject, there are three areas of study you're going to have to take seriously. Number one, and I'm going to put these in the order of importance. Number one, you're going to have to understand about Bible history. Number two, you're going to have to understand about world history. And number three, American history. We're going to begin a journey this morning that's going to begin about 1923 B.C. and try to come all the way up to August 17th, 2014. And we're going to do that by beginning in Genesis chapter 11, when Abraham, and I'm going to, by the way, in Genesis chapter 17 is where Abram's name was changed to Abraham and Sarai's name was changed to Sarah. Well, I'm going to just refer to them as Abraham and Sarah throughout the discussion. But Abraham, his father Terah, Abraham's wife Sarah, and his nephew Lot left the Ur of the Chaldees and journeyed as far as Haran, which is in the northern portion of Mesopotamia, or the Ur of the Chaldees. This portion of land or area today is known as Iraq. But according to Stephen's wonderful presentation of an Old Testament overview in Acts chapter 7, he points out that Abraham received the call while he was at home, that is, before he left. And that makes perfect sense. Why would he leave and move somewhere unless he was doing so under divine guidance or instruction? And so they come to Haran, where they remain for 5 years. And Terah, the father of Abraham, died while at Haran. And according to Joshua, chapter 24 and verse 2. Terah, Abraham's father, was an idolater, which makes a most interesting discussion or investigation is how in the world Abraham became a believer in God. We don't know a lot of that information, but his dad was an idolater. Well, at this time, Genesis 12, 1 to 4, God calls Abraham again and speaks to him and tells him to begin his journey, continue his journey. He's going to direct him. It'll be to the land of Canaan, and he's going to make of him a great nation. He's going to be a blessing, and all of those who bless him, that is his name, will be blessed, and all those who curse his name will be cursed. And then he said, in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Now that is a significant statement in our study this morning. In thee, that is in Abraham, shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Well, they continue their journey over 1,000 miles from his home to a place called Canaan. And in Genesis 14 and verse 13, Abraham is called the Hebrew. This is the first time we come across that word. It was given apparently by the Canaanites, and it means one from beyond the river. And more than likely, it's referring to the river Euphrates. Now, some think it's the Jordan, but I think it's the Euphrates that's being referred to, but whatever. This is what he's referred to as. Now, in chapter 15 of Genesis, there was a member in the family by the name of Eliezer of Damascus. And since Abraham was getting on up in years and his wife Sarah, and knowing about the seed promise, he thought, well, maybe this man was the one of promise. And God said, no, you will father the one who is the promised seed. And so in Genesis chapter 16, and I want you to really pinpoint this chapter. This is one, not only one of the most significant chapters in Bible history, it's one of the most significant chapters in world history. Because in this chapter, Sarah, who, seeing that in her view, she was past any possibility of having children, she came up with a plan, and the design of that plan was to get God out of a difficulty. Because he had promised Abraham it would be through him that he would indeed father the seed, or the seed child, the heir would come through whom the promise would continue. And so she came up with a plan to take her handmaid, Hagar, to be his wife. He agreed and married Hagar, and as a result of that marriage, she conceived. And during the time in which she was expecting the child, she began to change her attitude towards her, towards Sarah, to the point that she looked on Sarah with contempt. And Sarah went to Abraham about it. She was quite upset about it, and actually started blaming him for the situation. It was her idea, wasn't his. But nevertheless, Abraham didn't want anything to do with it. He said, she is your servant or slave. You do with her whatever you want to. So she began to treat Hagar harshly. Hagar fled. But when she fled, an angel came to her and told her, Hagar, you go back. You go back to your mistress, Sarah. You stay under her. You do what she tells you to do. You're going to have a son. And that son's name is going to be Ishmael. And God is going to bless him and make of him a great nation. Now, I want you to listen carefully to this verse in verse 21 of Genesis 16. Verse 12, I'm sorry, of Genesis 16. And he, referring to Ishmael, shall be a wild ass among men. And his hand shall be against every man, and every man's hand shall be against him, and he shall dwell over against all of his brethren. I'm not aware of a single commentator that I've read both in and out of the church who have ever understood this passage as a reference to anyone other than the Arab nations that came through Ishmael. Because this characteristic of them is still the characteristic that is manifested by them today. It has never changed. We know what they're capable of doing. We see it every day. But our focus this morning is on trying to understand the situation especially from the standpoint of what the Bible teaches us about it. So Hagar listened to the angel. She returned back to her mistress, and was under her. In Genesis chapter 21, Sarah at the age of 90, Abraham at the age of 99, conceived miraculously, and she brought forth a son, and that son's name was Isaac. Now, in this particular event, when he was born, shortly thereafter, about 3 years apparently, Ishmael began to make fun of the little child. Sarah had enough of it. And she told Abraham, just to paraphrase, you get rid of that woman and you get rid of that child, they will not have a part in the heir of our son Isaac. Abraham was heartbroken and angry about it. And God told Abraham, you listen to what Sarah said, because she's right. He said, I will make of Ishmael a great nation. I promised you I would, and I will. But the seed promise is going to come through your son Isaac. So Ishmael and Hagar left. God watched over them and cared for them. Ishmael eventually married a woman from Egypt, and he ended up having 12 sons and one daughter. And what's interesting is his daughter would eventually marry Jacob's brother Esau. But of course, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit there, but still, that's what would happen. So Isaac, the son of promise, was born. When Isaac grew up and married, had Jacob and Esau, you remember Esau, because of his being so profane with regards to sacred things, God removed the promise from him as being the firstborn and gave it to Jacob. Jacob would become the promised seed. And in Genesis chapter 32 and verse 28, Jacob's name was changed to Israel. Now, that's the second significant name we've come across. We've come across the word Hebrew, and we've come across the word Israel. And we need to remember those words. There's going to be another word yet, and that will be the word Jew. And at the latter part, at the closing of this lesson, if time permits, I want to talk just a few minutes about those three names. But they are significant. Well, when you close out, and keep in mind this morning, because of time considerations, I have to cover a lot of material or skip a lot of things in order to get the lesson in. At the end of the book of Genesis, you have Joseph, the son of Jacob, that was second in command only to the Pharaoh of Egypt, and all of Joseph's family, his father and all of his family, are being under his care while in Egypt. And when you close out the book of Genesis, the nation of Israel is beginning to develop. Now, I'm going to stop right here for just a moment. When you study about the nation of Israel, you have to consider four things. Number one, their selection. When did they become the people of God? Number two, their period of trial or testing. Some 1,500 years in which they were faithful and then again unfaithful to God. Number three, their final rejection. When did God cast them off forever? And number four, who took their place? Those are the four questions or four significant points you have to understand about studying about this nation, because it has a great deal to do with how we look at that part of the Middle East today, and look at the nation of Israel today. All right, so now, as the time has come, in the book of Exodus, the nation of Israel has really multiplied. There's a new Pharaoh, and he's very concerned about them. He's afraid they're getting so large, they're going to cause a big problem. And so he puts them in bondage. And they're in bondage put under heavy bond for some 430 years, at which time they're led out of that bondage by Moses, and they're led from Egyptian bondage into the wilderness. It will turn out they will wander for about 38 years, but that wasn't God's intent. He exhorted Moses in Numbers chapter 13 and 14. He exhorted them to choose a prince from each of the 12 tribes, send them into the land of Canaan, let them spy it out, and come back and make preparation to take it. And you remember only Joshua and Caleb gave a good report. The rest of the spies, 10 of them, said, "We can't do it. There are too many of them. They're too large. They just can't be overcome." And as a result of creating that defeatist attitude among the Israelite people, God was angry. And those 20 years of age and older would die in the wilderness. A new generation of Israelites would enter into the promised land. The book of Deuteronomy was written for that very purpose, because it means, the word Deuteronomy means the second giving of the law. This was for that new generation. And under Joshua's leadership, they would eventually enter in to the land of promise, and which they would do. But in the process of all of this, when they started to drive out the inhabitants, they refused to drive out some of the nations. And as a result of that, God told Joshua, he said, "I'm not going to drive them out. I'm going to let them stay right where they are. And they're going to be what it amounts to is a thorn in the flesh to Israel for generations to come." And that turned out to be exactly what happened. But now time we get to the book of Judges. We read there are 15 judges, and they judged over a period of about 300 years. And what you have here is a constant cycle. You start out with Israel. They're in their promised land. And by the way, let me mention this before I forget it. When God made the land promise to Israel, it was conditional. And that condition was on their faithfulness. And if they became unfaithful, for example, in Joshua 23 and verse 16, Joshua said in the latter part of the verse, "Ye shall perish quickly off the land, off the good land which God hath given unto you." God told them, and He told them, and He told them, "If you disobey me, you lose that land." And when you study the book of Judges, you have them in the land, enjoying everything, then they go into apostasy. Well, when they do that, God allows those nations they refuse to drive out to oppress them and put them in bondage, in some cases removing them from their land. And then a judge would be raised up by God, deliver them back after they would repent, deliver them back to their land, and the cycle would start all over. And this went over and over and over again. In my judgment, the beginning of the end of Israel is what follows next. In 1 Samuel chapter 8, Samuel, who was the last of the judges, the people had told Samuel, after Samuel's sons had proved themselves wicked, and Samuel was getting old, and they would, you know, sometimes when people want something, they look for any excuse to have it. So they're blaming their decision. In other words, they say, "We've made this decision because of your situation. You're getting too old, number one. And number two, your sons are wicked. So we want a king like all the Oriental kingdoms that surround us." And Samuel was heartbroken. And he went to God in prayer, and God said, verse 7, He said, "Samuel, they haven't rejected you. They have rejected me, that I should not reign over them." Well, when God said this, He told Samuel, "You tell them, if they want a king, you tell them exactly what they can expect from that type of arrangement." And he did. And they said, "We don't care. We want a king." So He gave them a king. Saul, he reigned 40 years. David, he reigned 40 years. Solomon, he reigned 40 years. When Solomon, in his great wickedness, 1 Kings 11, his multiple marriages to women of idolatry, God said, because of your wickedness, I'm going to take the kingdom away from you, but not in your lifetime, because of your father David. When Solomon died, 1 Kings chapter 12, all the children of Israel came to Shechem to make his son Rehoboam the rightful king. But you remember Rehoboam was so harsh with the people that they rebelled. And 10 tribes went off with Jeroboam, and they made him their king. And Jeroboam immediately began to set up rival places of worship, rival feast days, and so forth. In other words, he did everything he could to make it convenient for those of the 10 tribes so they wouldn't ever bother with going to Jerusalem again. Because he knew if they started going back to Jerusalem, they might reconcile. Well, anyway, Rehoboam became king over the two tribes of Judah and Benjamin. This would continue a number of years, and then you had the northern kingdom, Jeroboam. You had the southern kingdom, Rehoboam. In 721 B.C., Israel, the northern kingdom, sometimes called Ephraim, had so rebelled against God that he had cast them off for good. Assyria brought them into bondage, destroyed them, destroyed their city, their capital city, Samaria, took it over, and the northern kingdom was dispersed among the other peoples and passed out of existence. In 606 or 586, there's a debate over these dates, the southern kingdom also went into bondage under Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. And they would remain in bondage for 70 years. When that 70 years had been finished, they would come out of bondage. What's interesting, when you read about the Persian Empire, which their king allowed the Jews to return back to their homeland, to rebuild their city, to rebuild the walls of their city, to rebuild their temple, to rebuild their homes. And so you study the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, you read about that return under three leaders, Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah. But what's interesting is that most of the Jews refused to return back to their homeland. And what's interesting about that, in today's nation called Israel, you know what percentage of the world Jews live in Palestine? Less than 25% of the Jews. All the rest of them don't want to live there. They send a lot of money to help keep things going, but they have no desire to live there. They want that land protected, and we'll talk about that land a little bit later on. But they have no desire, just like they like the ease that they had under the Persians. And so when you study the fall of Israel, what you'll normally notice, you'll start out when they begin to make confederacies or agreements with heathen nations. That was their first mistake. Second of all, they began to be extremely lax among themselves about moral issues. Just let the people live any way they wanted to. And then third of all, they loved ease. They liked the idea of being comfortable. And so that's contributed to their fall. When you'll notice after the kingdom was divided, you'll notice from the time in which they were under captivity to Babylon, from then on, they have been in subjection to other nations. Now, some people say, well, they're not in subjection to anybody today. You don't know much about history. They are allowed to do what they do today. The nation of Israel could easily be crushed, and I'll tell you why in just a minute. if it were so desired. If the United States or Great Britain or France, either any of those three, chose to do it, there's nothing they could do to stop it because they're that small. Matter of fact, I'll just go ahead and tell you that right now, how small they are. When God promised the land promise, the land promise would cover about 60,000 square miles, Numbers 32. The state of Alabama is 52,000 square miles. So the whole nation of Israel was a little larger than the state of Alabama. Present day Israel, you can drive from north boundary to the southern boundary in about 3 hours. You can drive from the western boundary to the eastern boundary in about an hour. There are counties in the state of Texas that are bigger than the nation of Israel. That's how small they are. And you've got all of those people crammed in there. You not only have the Jews, you've got Arabs living also in that same area. Not just across, not just in Gaza, but right there in Jerusalem. But that's this era that we're talking about. That's where all this bloodshed and all this fighting is about. But what we need to know is, what does that have to do with what the Bible history teaches? When you close out the Old Testament, you have about 400 years of silence as far as any revelation. And it was during these times that the Apocrypha books were written. But it was also during this time that the Roman Empire was established and began to show its strength. And by the time of the birth of Christ, Rome was in control of most of the world. And so when Jesus came, you remember he commissioned his apostles just to do their work among the Jews, not to go to those that were not Israelites or Jews. And that was the limited commission, and that's what they did. But when Jesus died and was crucified, being delivered by the Jews themselves to the Romans to be put to death, you remember that Jesus told his apostles that in Luke 24 and verse 47, that repentance and remission of sin should be preached in my name, beginning at Jerusalem. Even though they had rejected him, he commanded them, the apostles, you will begin the evangelistic effort of the world from Jerusalem. Now, when in studying the this part of the, Matthew 23, 37 and 38. Jesus was talking about the city of Jerusalem. And he said, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, that killeth the prophets and stoneth them that are sent unto her. How often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and ye would not? Behold," watch this, "your house is left unto you desolate." That was God's rejection of them forever. Now, you say, "You mean they can't be saved?" No, I'm not saying that. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But on September 7th, A.D. 70, Titus, the Roman general, crushed Jerusalem, destroyed it. Jesus had prophesied in Matthew 24 to his apostles that when that would take place, that temple, that one of the great wonders of construction the temple, not one stone would be left upon another. And what's interesting, Titus, the Roman general, was impressed with that structure. He wanted to save it, but his soldiers were out of control, and they completely destroyed it, just like Jesus said that they would. And so in A.D. 70, the Jews fell. But not long after their fall, the Arab peoples began to move into that land. And as a matter of fact, they would occupy that land for the better part of some 1,900 years. What is interesting about this, in the latter part of the 6th century, A.D. 570 to be exact, August the 20th, was the birth of Mohammed. And 100 years after Mohammed's death, on June 8th, 632, the Arab nations were under Muslim law. All of them. I remember the late guy in Wood said, is the greatest area of concern for religion is the development of this religion. They are building mosques in the United States at the rate of one per week. They have, for the most part, already taken over France to a large degree. They're claiming within the next 10 years they're going to have Great Britain. And they said that their sights are set dead on us because we're really the last stronghold for them. They have every intention to take over our nation as well. And what is so sad is that our politicians are making it so easy for them. It wouldn't surprise me if history eventually bears out, if this nation falls and it's definitely heading in that direction, we might be taken over without firing a shot or a shot being fired, because it's being taken over every day. More and more of our corporations are being sold outside of the United States, being bought up outside of the United States. But what has happened is now we are on the border again, being drawn further into this conflict in the Middle East. When the 19th century came, there was a Jew by the name of Theodore Herzl, H-E-R-Z-E-L. And he came up with the idea that the Jews had the rightful place, or had their rightful place in Palestine. That's where they belonged. And they should be able to go there. Now, some Jews had gone to Palestine or lived there for a time, but they were constantly being harassed by the Arabs and in some cases killed over the years. But at the end of the First World War, 1918, Great Britain, who had an army of occupation then in Palestine and who had been supported tremendously by the Jews during that war, their financial support, they were very sympathetic about the Zionist movement. And so they, along with the United States and France, all of them working together, agreed for Jews that wanted to return to Palestine or Jerusalem and that area, what's called Israel today, could. And thousands of them, especially from Russia, returned back to their homeland. The Arabs didn't like it one bit. And when talk started circulating that they had every intention, that is, the Jews had every intention to establish statehood, they really got upset. And there were constant skirmishes going on day and night. Great Britain was right there in the middle of it. When the Second War was coming about, Adolf Hitler, when he began his push through the lower countries, he was expelling Jews everywhere that he went. And by the end of that war, there were hundreds of thousands of Jews that had been displaced. So again, Great Britain, United States, and France encouraged other nations to support them in this, which they did, and they allowed 250,000 Jews to return back to Palestine. Now, I want you to stop for a moment. I want you to think about how small I told you that country is. Now you have 250,000 people who've come there to live. The Jews were determined to get that land. The Arabs were determined to hold it. The Jews engaged in what we might call guerrilla warfare against Great Britain. In 1947, Great Britain had enough of it and pulled out. And the day they did, the Jews and the Arabs went to war. In short order, the Jews defeated the Arabs. This statement has nothing to do with looking down of one nation against another. It's the fact of the matter. But the fact of the matter is the Jews are far above the Arabs intellectually, number one. And number two, they are far above them militarily. Some of their fighter pilots are considered the best in the world. They are people that are highly intelligent. But when Palestine, when the Arabs fought against them, they lost. And on May 14, 1948, the nation of Israel established its own government. Ever since that time, there have been wars and fightings after fightings. We read about it every day. It's an absolute mistake to try to deal with these nations without a good, solid background of Bible history. What bothers me, I'm afraid one of these days history is going to point out that all of the soldiers that we've lost over there will have died for absolutely nothing. If you watch these people every day, they can't live at peace among themselves, much less with anybody else. Just exactly as God said it would be about those people that would descend through Ishmael. And so now we have the situation. But what do we have about the situation? Why isn't it, or why is it the way that it is? Or what is the solution, if there is any solution? Here is the solution, but it's never going to be taken advantage of. At least there's no indication of it. Because both nations have already rejected that solution. Both Israel and the Arab peoples, or the Muslim religion, has rejected Jesus Christ. He's the Prince of Peace. And he's the only one that can bring them together. And since neither one of them believe in him, there's not going to be any solution. Now, I mentioned to you a few minutes ago, oh, by the way, I don't want to leave this out. With all due respect to this great woman, Sarah, she had no idea the monster she helped create. That marriage is what brought about the Arab peoples. That's the problem area of the world. All because she was trying to help God out. And I hope that teaches all of us a lesson. God doesn't need our help. He needs our obedience. And we don't need to act for God because we never know what the consequences may be. We mention the name Israel, Hebrew, and Jew. All Arabs are Hebrews because they're descendants of Abraham. All Israelites are Hebrews because they are descendants of Abraham. So Arabs and Jews are both Hebrews. Only the nation of Israel came through Jacob. So no Arab is an Israelite. But also, the Jew, the name came from Judah and Benjamin when the tribes divided. All Jews are Israelites, but not all Israelites are Jews. The Jews are those who descended through Judah and through Benjamin. The others did not, so therefore they're Israelites, but they're not Jews. But here we have the nation facing us up to this morning. I noticed in the paper or on the internet before I came to service this morning, I noticed there was a march yesterday, and a peaceful one supposedly, in Huntsville, Arabs and Jews, about the conflict in the Middle East. Well, marching's all well and good, but it's not going to change anything. You've got people who hate each other. And you shouldn't be surprised. Remember, both of them came through Sarah. Through Abraham. Ishmael, the Arab peoples; Isaac, the Israelite people. Okay? So all of these nations, these two conflicts, Sarah and Hagar hated each other, and their descendants have hated each other ever since.